The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. We're starting off with Oprah's Insider section. Oprah remembers Phil Donahue. There would be no The Oprah Winfrey Show without The Phil Donahue Show. And this article is by Oprah Winfrey. Hi, Insiders. This week, I was very sad to learn of the passing of an old friend, the trailblazing talk show host Phil Donahue. Before Phil, talk shows for women offered little more than makeup tips and recipes. He shook that up. He changed the conversation and brought radically new ideas into our living rooms, proving that daytime TV viewers cared about everything from world leaders to the AIDS epidemic. I've said it before and I'll say it again. There would be no The Oprah Winfrey Show without The Phil Donahue Show. He invented the genre, cutting through all the game shows and soap operas on daytime TV back then. I once asked him, while sitting on a rocker on the terrace of his Manhattan penthouse, "Did you know you were paving the way for a black woman like me?" He told me he was too busy trying to keep the feather in the air to worry about who was coming up behind him. Phil won 20 Emmys for his show, and just a few months ago he earned the Presidential Medal of Freedom. But more than that, more than the 29 years and 7,000 episodes of The Phil Donahue Show he left behind, I hope he will be remembered for his generosity of spirit, the way he unified us, and the way he changed hearts and minds. My thoughts are with his wife of 44 years, Marlo, and his children, Michael, Kevin, Daniel, Mary Rose, and Jim. Rest in peace, Phil. This next article comes from the Lifestyle and Wellness section. The shower habit that will reset your brain. If you can breathe through the shock of an ice-cold rinse, you can get through pretty much anything. And this article is by Niall, that's N-I-A-L-L, O-Murchu, M-U-R-C-H-U. Finally, they were all asleep in bed. My partner, Josie, and I had tidied the house after the day's chaos. We had made all the baby bottles and lunches for the next day. Our four children were under the age of four. We had gotten through another day. It was late. It was a dark, wintry night in Dublin. Josie and I slumped down on the couch. What next? Watch Netflix? I wish. We were in the middle of a cold shower challenge. Each night, when the day's work was done, we would spend some time breathing together, and then the most difficult part, we'd take a cold shower. Why on earth were we doing this? As well as having four humans to raise and both having a career, we were suffering from heartache. Josie's brother, John, had died in the hospital at the end of our road, after a torturous battle with prostate cancer. We were grief-stricken, and if I'm being honest, we were in a bit of a hole. We needed something to get us out of it. We had heard about the healing benefits of cold water, especially for dealing with grief and tragedy, and so had committed to having a cold shower every day. But the only time we could carve out for ourselves was last thing at night. So there we were, sitting on the couch together, knowing that the cold shower was upstairs waiting for us. A cold shower is probably the most convenient path into the world of cold exposure and its many benefits. In addition to inducing feelings of exhilaration and invincibility, there are surprising effects on the brain. Researchers at the University of Cambridge in the UK discovered that cold exposure may protect from degenerative diseases like dementia, while a study from the Virginia Commonwealth School of Medicine found that participants who took daily cold showers reported a decrease in depression symptoms. But, like many beneficial things, it's difficult and a bit grim. That's because, over a lifetime, many of us have grown up with deliciously hot showers. We are conditioned to see the shower and expect a warm experience. So when we start cold showering, it's a real shock to our system on every level. Not only is the water cold, we'll talk more about how to deal with this in a moment, but every cell in the body expects the water to be warm. This is a new type of shock. We crave the old way. Also, our bodies know we can just step back out of the cold shower. There's a quick escape if we want to take it, and that's very tempting. But within all this shock and chaos lies the secret of the cold. It can enrich our lives. It can become a force for good. We have to be brave, though. I'm often told by people that they hate the cold, that they despise the cold, that they can't stand the cold. Why such strong emotions? In certain ways, the cold is like a mirror. It reflects back to us all the fear, worries, pain, discomfort, and uncertainty we are holding on to, most of which we are unaware of. All this comes rushing up to the surface when we are faced with the cold. We feel fear. We feel strong resistance. I want to be clear here. We want both hot and cold in our lives. We've evolved over millions of years to a point where, in some parts of the world, we can simply press a button and hot water flows out of the shower. Let's enjoy that. What I am suggesting, though, is that we should enjoy a nice hot shower and then at the end of it, turn it cold. That moment of truth of turning the tap is the most difficult bit. Before I teach you how, I want to ask you a question. Do you really want to do it? Let me put that another way. Do you want to learn to conquer your fear? Do you want to learn to face the difficulties in your life? Do you want to learn to be serene despite the pressure you face? Do you want to feel calm and peaceful again? Do you want to feel powerful every day? Do you want to feel more alive? Do you want to feel victorious? Do you want to feel strong? Do you want to feel alive? If the answer is yes, then it is time to turn that tap from hot to cold. My suggestion is to incorporate it into your usual hot shower routine. Whenever you usually have a hot shower, now you do the same but finish with cold. It's important to set an intention, though. You have to commit to doing it, so let's do that now. Imagine yourself in your lovely hot shower. Imagine now deciding it's time to turn that tap. Imagine the cold water splashing down on you. It can feel like an explosion. It's shocking. We recoil from the water. Our minds burst into fear. Usually, there's a fairly loud voice in our heads saying, "Get out of here." Welcome to the chaos. This is what we want. This is where we find all the deep benefits. This is where we learn a lot about ourselves. This is where the cold teaches us. We voluntarily put ourselves into this difficult position to learn how to get out of it. It's like a battle every time we turn that tap. When it's over, we feel victorious. In the chaos, we lose track of our breathing entirely. It becomes erratic, fragmented, and uneven. Our inhalations become short, painful attempts at trying to breathe. Our exhalations disappear. We want to find our exhalations, no matter how small they might be, and begin to focus on them. Initially, our exhalations will be short and choppy. They'll feel out of control. But we must focus on them. We must begin to work on them, mechanically and consciously moving our lungs so they get longer and stronger. Work them. Keep focusing on them until we feel they are steadily and strongly flowing outward. It is work. The cold is relentless and will continuously try to take our breath away again. So we have to keep working on controlling our exhalations, keeping them steady, breathing out, and trying to control our breath. Let's practice it now as you read. On your next inhalation, breathe in gently and deeply. And now, slowly and steadily, breathe all the way out. When you reach the bottom of your exhalation without forcing it, breathe gently back in, and now breathe slowly all the way out again. When you reach the bottom of your breath, breathe in again. This slowing down, this softening, then takes us deeper along the path into the cold. Then a sense of calm arises in us, despite the relentlessness of the cold. The cold water is still splashing on us, but we feel calm despite it. The cold will continue to try to take our breath away, but we are at peace in the chaos. We are in control. We are calm, despite the chaos. When we can find a sense of control and calm in the chaos of the cold, we can then find it anywhere. The cold teaches us to find balance and tranquility despite whatever pressure we are facing. When we breathe our way into calmness in the cold, we can then do it anywhere. If a really difficult situation arises at work or home, we now know we can handle it. We know because of our daily battle and victory in the cold shower that we can find a sense of calm and control by focusing on our exhalation. This allows us to react differently to difficult situations. It allows us to feel differently and think differently despite the fear or worry we face. We are in control. We are calm despite the pressure. Your mastery of the cold has begun. And there's a book that accompanies this article, The Power of Cold, How to Embrace the Cold and Change Your Life. And it's 21% off right now, so it's $16 at Amazon. And parts of this article were edited due to time. This is another article from the Lifestyle and Wellness section. Why are the weight loss drugs so freaking expensive? The miracle drugs are here, we just can't afford them. This article is by Rosie Hopegood. The world of obesity medication has changed dramatically in recent years, spelling a new era for the 100 million Americans living with the disease today. We finally have a tool in our toolbox that's double the efficacy of any medication we've had in the past, says Amanda Velasquez, MD, Director of Obesity Medicine at Cedars-Sinai. These semaglutide medications result in 50% weight loss for the average individual over the course of 68 weeks. It really has been a game changer. There are four blockbuster drugs on the market, Wegovy and Zepbound, which are FDA approved for weight loss, and Ozempic and Mounjaro, which are approved for diabetes, but still commonly prescribed off-label for weight loss. Analysis at Goldman Sachs predict that by 2030, 15 million Americans will be on these drugs. But with limited insurance coverage and monthly out-of-pocket prices of about $900 to $1,300, the question is, how will they afford it? While the list price of $1,300 a month is floated a lot, that's not the amount drug companies charge much of the time. In fact, there is no universal set price. As well as the list price, there's also what we call the net price. which is negotiated and paid for by your health plan, says Stacy B. Dusetzina, that's D-U-S-E-T-Z-I-N-A, PhD, a professor of health policy at Vanderbilt University Medical Center. They tend to have really substantial discounts and rebates, but that net price is usually not available to somebody paying cash. For example, someone who doesn't qualify for the meds through insurance. This week, ZepBound got a lot more affordable for the millions of people who don't qualify through insurance. The drug will now be available to buy directly from maker Eli Lilly for a significantly reduced price of $399 for the lower dose of 2.5 milligrams, predominantly used as a one-month starter dose for new patients, and $549 for a higher dose of 5 milligrams for a four-week supply. This is at least 50% cheaper than any other list price for GLP-1 medication. The reason for the lower price, Eli Lilly is cutting out the middlemen, such as telehealth companies and concierge docs, who add hefty markups and will be selling the drug in vials rather than the costlier, trickier-to-manufacture preloaded pen form, also known as an auto-injector. This means users will need to use a syringe to draw the drug out of a vial. There are two additional factors to keep in mind before ordering directly from Eli Lilly's self-pay pharmacy, Lilly Direct. You'll still need a prescription from your doctor, and even the higher dose of 5 milligrams may not be right for you. There are four higher strengths available in pen form. The max is 15 milligrams. Up until recently, the drugs have been FDA approved only for weight loss or diabetes, and insurance coverage has been patchy. But in March, the FDA approved Wegovy to reduce cardiovascular risk in overweight people, after a clinical study showed the drug cut the risk of heart attacks and strokes by as much as 20% for overweight people with a history of heart disease. This is big news, and will likely pressure insurers and the government to widen its Wegovy coverage. There are the three main reasons why GLP-1 drugs cost so much. Number one, drug companies are cashing in while they can. Novo Nordisk, the Danish creator of Ozempic and Wegovy, made $4.8 billion from the drugs in the third quarter of 2023 alone, boosting the economy in Denmark and leading to lower interest rates for ordinary Danes. While the manufacturer's list price, the amount most people will pay out of pocket for Ozempic, is around $1,000 a month, the minimum profitable price to produce the drug is much lower. In a study from May 2023, when the list price was $804, the estimated minimum cost was around, brace yourself, $40 a month. Granted, there are some hidden costs involved. People are often interested in why, when it costs a couple pennies to make this drug, manufacturers charge so much money for it, says Joseph F. Levy, PhD, a health economist at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. But we're reimbursing for our other costs, such as the innovation that went into creating it, including the failed drug developments that did not bring billion-dollar drugs to market. Drug trials alone can cost hundreds of millions of dollars. Of course, these prices are still drastically inflated. In 2022, the Institute for Clinical and Economic Review estimated that a fair price for them would be 44 to 57% cheaper than current prices. So what are these companies basing their prices on? They're able to charge what the market will bear, whatever insurers and consumers will pay, says Levy. Because these drugs are so revolutionary and there is little in the way of competition, people who can afford them are willing to pay a premium. Another reason for the astronomical amounts is that companies have a relatively short window of time to earn money from their creations. Drug patents last 20 years. But that time frame includes the many years it takes to test a drug before it's brought to market. When the patent lifts, it's a free-for-all as rival companies create copycat generic versions. Once a generic is allowed to come to market, that often will lower the price of a drug by 80%, says Levy. Mark 2031 in your calendar, that's when Ozempic's patent runs out. However, Levy points out that drug makers often try their hardest to prevent generics from coming to market for as long as possible, so it may not happen overnight. It's important not to confuse future generic versions of drugs, which will require FDA approval, with the unregulated and unapproved compounded forms of these drugs that may be popping up in your Instagram feed. Velazquez strongly advises against them. I can understand the desperation to gain access to these drugs, but we don't want individuals to be putting themselves at risk when we just don't know what comes with these compounded forms. Number two, the U.S. government is hands-off. American Ozempic consumers are paying around 10 times what people are paying in Sweden, France, Australia, and the U.K., and 5 times more than those in Japan. In Denmark, where semaglutide was developed, the drug costs $3,500 a year. Given the high rates of obesity in this country, not to mention the fact that 90% of all Wegovy sales are from the U.S., these figures are stark. But before you plan an international trip to stock up, note that in Europe, a prescription is needed to buy these drugs. You may also have heard about people buying them in Mexico and Canada, but this is strongly discouraged by doctors because of the lack of regulation and safety checks and the potential for fake drugs. In many other countries, governments regulate how much pharmaceutical companies can charge. Not here. Generally, Americans pay more for drugs than people do in other countries by a significant margin, due to the government's reluctance to require drug companies to make their products more affordable to consumers. It's a reflection of the capitalistic market in this country, with healthcare as part of that capitalistic paradigm, unfortunately, says Velazquez. It's unclear whether Ozempic and company will be the drugs that finally persuade the government to negotiate fair prices with pharmaceutical giants, but there's certainly a clear financial incentive for them to do so. In the U.S., obesity costs the healthcare system around $173 billion a year. Goldman Sachs recently predicted that GLP-1 drugs could boost the U.S. economy by $1 trillion in the next 4 years, more or less, because of their potential to improve health outcomes and boost productivity. Number three, the shortage is real. In May 2023, Novo Nordisk took the drastic step of limiting the supply of the lowest doses of Wegovy. Patients generally need to be on a starter dose, gradually increasing doses over a few weeks as they adjust to the drug. By limiting access to the lowest 3 doses, Novo Nordisk limited the number of people who could begin treatment, thereby protecting the supply for those already on the drug. The reason for this shortage? Somehow it hadn't foreseen the enormous demand for the drug after the FDA approval. Novo Nordisk did not do a great job projecting how much appetite there was for these drugs, says Levy. It's not like you just flip a switch and you make it. You need whole facilities that take a long time to build. Eli Lilly, the makers of Mounjaro and Zepbound, have also struggled to meet demand with only limited supplies of higher doses available. These shortages across the board have driven up the price consumers were willing to pay. The good news is that Novo Nordisk has contracted with new manufacturers and is investing about $6.5 billion in production. In February, it announced that lower Wegovy doses are now available to patients and that supply chain issues should be easing throughout the year. Meanwhile, Eli Lilly says it is expanding production this year. Will they get cheaper? We are anticipating that prices will go down, but how much is still the big question, says Velazquez. She adds, even if they were to decrease, will it be enough to convince insurers and employers to expand access to treatment for obesity? Right now, our biggest challenge is that they're not necessarily convinced that by investing up front in these medications to treat obesity upstream, it will offset the cost of treating the medical conditions related to weight downstream. According to Novo Nordisk, about 50 million Americans with obesity should be able to access Wegovy through insurance. But this is not the case for the more than 58 million users of Medicare, which is typically one of the largest payers for prescription drugs for people over 65 and for people with permanent disabilities, according to Duzetzina. They do not cover these drugs for weight loss at all, although they will cover them for diabetes, she says. Legislation has been proposed to try to change that, but so far, nothing has changed. Another reason more people may gain access through insurance is that, as Levy notes, there are many clinical trials underway testing how these drugs work as a treatment for things like congestive heart failure and sleep apnea. Once the FDA approves the drugs for a new condition, see Wegovy above, presto. Insurers and employers are having to revisit which higher-risk populations they would consider coverage for, says Velasquez. They are looking at the health economics and cost-benefit ratio. If an individual has a higher burden of medical conditions that are weight-related. In other words, they're accessing whether it's cheaper to treat someone's obesity or the related conditions that bubble up from obesity down the line. In the near future, there's hope for improved insurance coverage. Plus, several new weight loss drugs are in the clinical trial phase, and increased competition in the marketplace could well lower prices. In the meantime, here's to waiting for those generics to hit the shelves. Over in lifestyle, but this is the wholeness section this time, 12 gratitude journal prompts to practice daily. Fun fact, in psychological research, gratitude is associated with positive emotions and greater happiness. This article is by Sophia Lodato. It's no surprise that meditation and self-care can make us feel significantly better. In fact, there are proven health benefits. Yet, as hard as we may try, it's too often second nature to focus on the things we feel are wrong in our lives. But through gratitude practices, you can become more attuned with your highest self and begin to look at life through a pure lens of love. And finally, fully see and appreciate the blessings that have always been there. Ahead, you'll find 12 gratitude journaling prompts to help rewire your brain to focus on the positives in your life and in the world. It's easy to be grateful for obvious joys, like a promotion at work or family and friends. But are you aware of how often you truly feel grateful? Knowing and feeling are two different states of being, and the latter allows you to be fully present and notice the smaller delights in life. And if you're really feeling inspired, consider purchasing Oprah's The Life You Want Planner to make living, well, a daily practice with Oprah as your guide. Describe your favorite moment of each part of the day. At the end of the day, write three things for which you're grateful. One about your morning, one about your afternoon, and one about your evening. This forces you to search for the good because, let's face it, that can be challenging when your boss is nagging you. But we promise the good exists in all parts of the day. Think on a success you had and who helped you. It's your thank you speech, if you will. Be sure to describe in great detail how you wouldn't be where you are now without said person or thing. You can even send them the note when you've finished writing it, but only if you feel called to share. Write about a pet and what makes them special. If you don't have a pet, skip this one. But if you have had a pet at any point in your life, you know just how important furry friends truly can be. They offer unconditional love and comfort. So, what about your pet is special? How does your pet make you feel? If your pet has moved on from this life, what parts of them do you deeply miss? One of the best experiences in my life was... Write about an experience that reminded you of life's magic. Explain the experience and then write why you are grateful. What about the experience was unique? Who was with you? Writing about it not only keeps the memory alive, but also allows you to deeply feel how you felt in that moment. Make a list of 10 things you love about yourself. From your physical characteristics to your personality, write a list of 10 things that make you, well, you. These should be aspects of yourself that you really appreciate and admire. If you have a hard time celebrating yourself, instead, think of how your best friend would describe you. For example, if you like that you're personable, write it down. Open your phone and describe a photo you like. Why are you grateful for this photo? Who in the photo are you grateful to have in your life? While it's important to not get stuck in the past, reflecting can help us remember and appreciate significant moments and people. Write about a tradition for which you're grateful. Traditions can make you feel a sense of belonging and bring great comfort. In a chaotic world, honoring and continuing traditions can add meaning and connection to life. What is your favorite tradition? If you don't have a significant one, it's never too late to begin a tradition with family, friends, or even coworkers. What is a failure or mistake in your life for which you're grateful? Recognizing your failures or mistakes can allow you not to repeat them again. Through these perceived failures, you can learn valuable lessons that may make you rethink and reconsider your decisions and self. So why not pick one and write about it? What's something you're grateful to have today that you didn't have a year ago? Think big and small. New people in your life or a new job may make you feel grateful. But how about your own personal growth? Do you feel more creative, independent, or determined than you were a year ago? Just like a newborn baby, these things are worth celebrating too. Get to know your inner self. Knowing, loving, and being grateful for yourself all starts by exploring the inner you, your inward swirl of emotions, energies, and abilities. Connecting to that source of love is a key step in finding gratefulness. Write down the words or phrases, or if you can't find the words, try drawing a sketch that describe the best version of your inner self and focus on getting deep, your wants, your joys, the things you carry in your heart. Build gratefulness through self-respect. Author Joan Didion said that character, the willingness to accept responsibility for one's own life, is the source from which self-respect springs. Take a moment to think about the ways you show up for yourself. Try listing all the ways you take responsibility for your actions. Reflect on the fun of life. There is nothing like the gift of laughter to help melt away the stress of the day. Ask yourself, what was the last thing that really made me laugh? Write everything you can remember to figure out what has brought you joy recently and what you can do to keep chasing that feeling. This is in the culture and news and books section. I spoke out against library book bans. Then the death threats started. In her new memoir, That Librarian, middle school educator Amanda Jones opens up about being targeted, slandered, and ostracized for standing up for the right to read and why she's still not backing down. This article is by Amanda Jones. Amanda, you are indoctrinating our children with perversion, plus pedophilia grooming. Your evil agenda is getting print, plus national coverage. Congrats. continue with your LGBT agenda in On Our Children, because we're going to put your fat, evil, commie, P-E-D-O ads in the dirt very soon. You can't hide. We know where you work plus live. You have a large target on your back. Click, click. See you soon. Death threat received on August 14, 2022. Subject line, Alphabet Agenda. When I opened this email on August 14, 2022, my hands started to shake, and I immediately began gasping for breath. The absurdism of it also crossed my mind. And I had the fleeting thought that my preteen students could write better emails than this. But there's nothing funny about receiving a threat on your life. I began again to wonder what possessed someone to send another human being such an email. Sadly, I'd been spending a large portion of the previous weeks pondering why random strangers go online to put down, troll, threaten, and defame people whom they've never met. I am a middle school librarian in a small town called Watson in the southern Louisiana parish of Livingston. I have lived here all my life and have never thought of leaving. I bought the house next door to my childhood home and am lucky to have my parents as my closest neighbors. Watson sits some 20 miles southeast of Baton Rouge on what folks consider part of the Delta. The land is flat and the sky is big. And in the summer, the air is like a steaming wet blanket. The town isn't much to look at, and in the flood of 2016, much of it was leveled. Now that was something. But generally, Watson is a place with few surprises, and that's a lot of what I love about it. Life has its regular rhythms, and I love those rhythms. Love my job, my friends, my family. I take great satisfaction in being a school librarian, which puts me in the heart of the community, all the kids and their families, and the rituals of the calendar year. I still feel like Livingston Parish is a good place, but I was not prepared for the surprise it threw at me. On the night I spoke up at the library meeting, I was one of almost 30 speakers who registered their concerns about possible censorship and book banning. There was rumor afoot that a library board member had been making comments about LGBTQIA+ books and was questioning the purchase of certain books. These librarians all had an impending sense of doom, that there would be a move to censor books with LGBTQIA+ characters. I wanted to go and speak about the harmful effects that censoring these books can have on our LGBTQIA+ students. I have taught queer students who have been mocked in our community. I have taught queer kids who grew up and took their own lives due to the loneliness of ostracization, and have watched dozens of our younger citizens move away from our parish to more inclusive environments because they are sick of their ill treatment. I'll be if I'm going to stand in silence while we lose another kid because of something our community has done to make them feel less than. But I also worried about the library in general and was concerned about where this was headed. The meeting was held at the Livingston Public Library, not my middle school library. I went as a citizen. I told them I was a 44-year resident, a mother of a child in our school system, and a library card holder since 1983. I reminded them that our public library was one of our parish's biggest assets, something we could be proud of, and reminded them, regardless of their own beliefs on the topic of book content and location, to think about this. No one on the right side of history has ever been on the side of censorship and hiding books. I said, hate and fear disguised as moral outrage have no place in Livingston Parish. The 7-member library board was seated up front, and there was a good crowd of locals. 2 men, one from out of town and one local, also attended the meeting, and they are at the root of the attack on me. After I dared to speak, and after the others dared to speak, these 2 men zeroed in on yours truly. It took a few days, four to be precise, but on that fourth day, a Saturday, I opened social media to a barrage of hate. The first post was made on Facebook by a local group called Citizens for a New Louisiana, a group that has wreaked havoc on public libraries across Louisiana. Citizens is led by Executive Director Michael Lunsford. Citizens is a dark money nonprofit group in Louisiana whose director often posts the usual conspiracy theories about the jab, hate rhetoric toward the LGBTQIA+ community, and your typical far-right nonsense. But it's nonsense that is believed by a lot of people. They published my name and said that I was fighting hard to keep sexually erotic and pornographic materials in the kids' section of our public library. They identified me as a school librarian and questioned what kind of nefarious influence I had over six-year-olds. They posted a picture of me with a target around my head. According to them, it's just a circle. But who are they kidding? Post after post from them left me dumbfounded. How could anyone come to that conclusion from my statement opposing censorship? Sexually erotic and pornographic material in the kids' section? Six-year-olds? What if people actually believed this nonsense? I knew that social media was a vicious place. I just didn't know how diabolical it could be. I had made the decision to change my Facebook page before I went to the meeting. I had seen several librarian colleagues harassed after speaking out about censorship in their own towns, and I took preemptive measures to protect myself. I knew that there could be backlash for standing up for the LGBTQIA+ and BIPOC communities in my conservative town. But I never would have dreamed that strangers and friends would stoop so low with their lies and personal attacks. The comments kept coming. Refresh, cry, try to breathe. Refresh, cry, try to breathe. Refresh, cry, try to breathe. That was my weekend, and it was a dark one. I never knew that it was possible to cry so much that your eyes bruise and swell shut. I never knew you could work yourself up to the point of not being able to draw breath in your lungs and cry so much that your sinuses close for a solid week. I never knew you could cry so much that you can soak the entire front of your shirt in a pillowcase. I'd like to make one thing clear. I had never spoken to these people in person or online. I didn't know them then, and I do not know them now. They merely chose me out of all the other speakers that night to target. I have my suspicions as to why they chose me. Who better to take down than the award-winning school librarian? These men wanted to make an example out of someone and scare the community into silence. It worked to some extent. The large crowd that showed up to defend intellectual freedom on July 19, 2022, dwindled to only a few at the next public library board meetings. Nobody wanted to speak out if it meant becoming the next target. If they could take the first steps to completely ruin my reputation with just a few online posts, they could ruin anybody's. People told me outright they were scared to speak up and support me publicly for fear of retribution. After 2 days of crying myself dry, the pity party morphed into fury. A burning animosity began to replace the sadness. How dare they tell these lies about me? This is my community of 44 years. I have devoted half of my life to my school and my students. I thought about the hours and years of going above and beyond in my job as an educator because I love my school almost as much as I love my family. I decided that I'd be if I sat back and allowed these two men to destroy my life. I wasn't the first to be targeted this way, and I knew I wouldn't be the last. Not unless I did something about it. I decided to take matters into my own hands and reclaim my reputation. I filed police reports, hired an attorney, and started the process of taking back my life. The messages of support started rolling in by the hundreds. People messaged me on social media and emailed. strangers, former students related how they were dealing with similar situations in their own town. One of my favorite authors, Newbery Award winner Aaron Entrada Kelly, tweeted, "This is Moxie, sending my love and support to you, Amanda. I'm so proud you're from my home state. Hashtag FREADOM. I was so honored by that tweet, I got a tattoo of the word Moxie on my left wrist to remind myself to hold fast in my determination and have courage. That bit of ink gives me strength, and when I start to doubt myself, it reminds me that I am on the right side of history. They wanted to silence me, which cemented my will to speak my truth. These groups operate by instilling fear so that no one will challenge them. And I knew it was important to take a stand. I knew I had privileges that others did not. It should not be up to the historically marginalized groups most at risk to be the only ones speaking out. I had the platform, the support, the connections, and lower risk to my job that put me in a position to fight back. If not me, then who? These people set out to destroy me, but they woke something up inside me that I hope never dies. The court labeled me a public figure, and their lawyers called me an activist when I was just a school librarian. I figure if people are going to label me an activist, I might as well act like one and show them what I'm made of, grit and perseverance. As my sister Melanie commented, those jerks sure did mess with the wrong one. Hell hath no fury like a librarian scorned." There's a book that accompanies this article, That Librarian by Amanda Jones. It's $23 at Amazon, $28 at bookshop.org, and $28 at Walmart. And parts of this article were edited due to time. In culture and news, Simone Biles wants justice for Jordan Chiles after she's stripped of bronze Olympic medal. Biles encouraged her teammate and friend to let it all out by Maya Ernest. Simone Biles is looking out for her Olympic teammate Jordan Chiles as the gymnast is facing being stripped of her bronze medal. In a new interview, Biles says she has been in contact with Chiles to uplift her amid some challenging moments. "We've been FaceTiming, texting, just being girls," Biles told People about her conversations with Chiles. "I did talk to her on one of the days, and I was like, you know what, Jordan, you have to feel all these feels. Don't let these emotions stop you. This will be the healthiest way to get all of this out." Speaking on Chiles having her medal revoked, Biles added, "It's an unfortunate circumstance because something like this has never happened before, and it's truly a shame. But we wish all three girls could get the medal, and unfortunately in gymnastics that's not the case." She continued to say that she wanted justice for her friend, as she didn't agree with the ruling to take away her medal. "Do we think they did the correct procedures to come to this ruling? No. That's really why we want that justice for Jordan and why we're going to keep supporting her and uplifting her," Biles concluded. The third place medal, which Chiles won in floor exercise at the Paris 2024 Olympics, was taken after the International Olympic Committee upheld findings that an appeal by her coach, which got the gymnast on the podium, shouldn't have been considered. Chiles had initially finished fifth, with a score of 13.666 in the women's floor exercise final on August 5th, before U.S. coach Cecile Landy successfully lobbied judges to raise her score, arguing that the athlete's difficulty score had been uncredited. Officials on the scene agreed and adjusted her score by 0.1 points to 13.766, which elevated Chiles above two Romanian athletes. That decision didn't go over well. Romanian Prime Minister Marcel Ciolacu said he'd refused to attend the Olympic closing ceremony in protest. Nearly a week later, the International Olympic Committee said on Sunday that it would abide by the Court of Arbitration for Sport, which ruled that Landy's protest was made 64 seconds after scores were posted, and the deadline for lodging such objections is 1 minute. Childs explained in a statement that the debacle had led her to now be confronted with one of the most challenging moments of my career. She added that the decision feels unjust and comes as a significant blow, not just to me, but to everyone who has championed my journey. Still in culture and news, Mariah Carey opens up about the tragic loss of her mother and sister. "My heart is broken. I appreciate everyone's love and support and respect for my privacy during this impossible time." This article is by Joel Kalfi. Mariah Carey is mourning two serious losses that came in the span of a single day. In a statement to People, the singer revealed that her mother, Patricia, 87, and her sister, Allison, 63, both passed away over the weekend. A cause of death has not been announced for either woman. "My heart is broken that I've lost my mother this past weekend. Sadly, in a tragic turn of events, my sister lost her life on the same day," Carey told the outlet. The Grammy winner noted that she was able to be by her mother's side in the older woman's final moments. "I feel blessed that I was able to spend the last week with my mom before she passed," Carey said. "I appreciate everyone's love and support and respect for my privacy during this impossible time." Patricia Carey was a classically trained opera singer and vocal coach, and she was the first person to vocally train her Vision of Love songstress daughter. However, Carey's relationship with her mom was a complicated one. When the singer released her memoir, The Meaning of Mariah Carey, in 2020, Carey dedicated the book to her mother, writing, "And to Pat, my mother, who, through it all, I do believe actually did the best she could. I will love you the best I can, always." When Patricia married Alfred Roy Carey, they had three children together, Morgan, Allison, and Mariah, who was the youngest. When their parents split, Allison went to live with her father, while Mariah and Morgan stayed with their mom. Throughout their adult lives, Carey was mostly estranged from her sister, but she referenced her sibling in her memoir, saying that Allison weathered much of the discomfort in their family. "I do know that what she experienced damaged and derailed her girlhood," Carey wrote. "She was fully aware when the family unit unraveled and our parents turned on each other. She absorbed the full pain of a family coming undone." Later, Carey complimented her sister, saying that as they grew up, Allison was extremely intelligent and curious, and she loved to learn. Again, in culture and news, Prince Harry to visit New York City in September. The Duke of Sussex will be in town to support his patronage and philanthropic initiatives, by Emily Burek. Prince Harry will be back in New York City soon. The Duke of Sussex will travel to New York in September. During UN General Assembly High Level Week and Climate Week in New York City, Prince Harry, the Duke of Sussex, will be in town to advance a number of his patronages and philanthropic initiatives, a spokesperson for Prince Harry said. He will participate in engagements with African Parks, the HALO, H-A-L-O, Trust, the Diana Award, and Travelist, that's spelled T-R-A-V-A-L-Y-S-T. In addition, he will be furthering the work of the Artwell Foundation, the nonprofit organization he co-founded with his wife, Megan, the Duchess of Sussex. More details will be shared as we approach the week of events. The UN General Assembly High Level Week takes place from September 21 through 28, and Climate Week takes place from September 22 through 29. But the specific dates Prince Harry will be in the city have yet to be shared. Last year, Prince William was in New York City during Climate Week 2023 for the Earthshot Summit. The Duke and Duchess of Sussex were last in New York City in October 2023 for their Archwell Foundation's first ever in-person summit. They were also in New York in May 2023 when Meghan was honored at the Miss Foundation 50th Anniversary Gala, after which their spokesperson said they were involved in a near-catastrophic car chase with paparazzi. Harry's upcoming visit to New York follows his and Meghan's four-day trip to Colombia, which took place earlier this month. And in culture and news, Justin and Hailey Bieber are overjoyed with their miracle baby. And that's by Maya Ernest. Justin and Hailey Bieber are officially parents, and it seems they're enjoying the first few days with their son, Jack Blues Bieber. Both the new mom and baby are doing well at home, a source close to Justin told People. They're both overjoyed. The baby is such a miracle. He's adorable and doing well, the source said. Hailey's doing well, too. According to the source, the couple's pregnancy news was something that they very much wished and prayed for. The day they found out Hailey was expecting was the best ever for Justin, the source continued. He was over the moon with excitement. It was a big celebration for them, and the days following baby Jack's birth, it seems Justin has naturally eased into parenthood. Justin's already a great dad, the source said. Late Friday night, the baby singer confirmed he and his wife had welcomed their son in an Instagram post, "Welcome home, Jack Blues Bieber," he wrote, alongside an image of Hailey holding Jack's tiny foot in her hand. In the last few weeks of her pregnancy, Hailey and Justin enjoyed their final moments as a family of two in an interview with W Magazine. The model said she was so in love with her husband that it was hard to picture adding another person to their dynamic. In the beginning of pregnancy, it was super emotional for me, she recalled. Like, I love this human so much, how can I possibly bring someone else into this? I'm trying to soak in these days of it being Justin and me, just the two of us now. It seems the couple is relishing their time with baby Jack. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. So long until next time.